Morning to you. I hope you had a good rest, and I'm so glad to see you back this morning. We're going to be talking about how to love a husband in this first session. I'm kind of excited about it. It's very different from how to love a wife. That would be something that you would expect. Let me do this first, though. At lunchtime, we're going to have Q&A, and let me make this suggestion. If you don't have a question that you'd like to have discussed, would you give a piece of advice to other couples on your card? And again, you can retain your anonymity. You don't have to put a name on it. But I think that would be helpful too. So give me one or the other, and we'll go through those at lunchtime. There's been some discussion about my grandchildren, and you may be surprised to know that I like to talk about my grandchildren. Ezra has just turned 2, and when he was about 6 months old, we bought him his rifle. We got him a rifle. I was flying back from somewhere up north, and I was sitting on the very back seat. Nobody likes to do that because the seat won't recline back there. But anyway, sitting up rigid in the back seat, and the attendant was sitting in a fold-down seat beside me, and then beside her was another woman on the other side there, and they were obviously Yankees. And they were having this conversation about people in the South and how the people in the South have that way of talking, you know, that's different. And they weren't being ugly, but they were going on about this, and I had about enough of that. And I said, "I'm from Alabama." Oh, good, good. And I said, "I have a new grandson. He just turned 6 months old." "Oh, that's nice." They were very friendly. I said, "We bought him a gun." They said, "Really? You know, really? Yes, we did." I said, "Would you like to hear about that?" "Yes." It's like, I said, "Well, Ezra is 6 months old and right now has 6 living fathers. He has 1 dad, 2 grandfathers, and 3 great-grandfathers. And his dad and I spent a considerable amount of time on this project, choosing the right gun for the boy. And what we decided on was a Henry Golden Boy lever action 22 with an octagon barrel. It's a beautiful gun. And each of the 6 fathers contributed equally to the purchase of the gun. And when we bought it, each of the 6 fathers wrote in the little book that came with the gun. We bought a good box of cartridges, each of the 6 fathers, and this took some doing because they don't live in the same place. They live kind of scattered. But we took the time, and each of the 6 fathers fired that gun once. And then we packaged it all up, including the box of cartridges. And on the occasion of his wedding, now you wouldn't want to give a boy a gun like this when he's 12, but on the occasion of his wedding, he'll be given the gun, and with explanation. I don't know if I'll be around then, but he'll be told what happened and given the gun, and he will shoot it the 7th time. And it will be his. And then, hopefully, if the Lord lets the world stand, and if the Lord gives him sons, why, the eldest will be given this gun. Now, there is a caveat. Oh, by the way, I told those northern, those Yankee women, I told them about this. I kind of think they might want to move to the South. I'm hoping that they will. They kind of like the gun story, I think. But the one caveat to it is that if Ezra has a brother, we'll have to repeat this. I mean, you know about Jacob and Joseph and the coat of many colors. You wouldn't want to repeat that. That would be a mistake. And so we'll have to do the gun thing again. It would have to be an identical one. But that's okay. You know, however many fathers are around, when the boy comes, why, we'll do the same thing. And so that's we're having a great time. It's a wonderful time of life. And the very idea, when Ezra twiddles those fingers at me and says, he draws out my name, "Papa, whatever I've got in this world, if he wants it, he can have it." That's just it. They quibble. Those women folks, they quibble about how much ice cream to get, how much candy, whatever. But that's not me. No. You know, whatever he wants, that's what we're going to do. See, we're going to do that because we're good friends. Well, let's get started. We're going to talk about how to love a husband first. And I want to preface this by saying that the Word of God is right. You got to start this by erasing what you think of from society about the roles of men and women, because a lot of what I'm going to talk about this morning is countercultural. It goes cross-culture. And I'm not embarrassed about that, and I'm not going to apologize for it. The Word of God is always going to read the same way. It's very much like the weather. You know, how do you like the weather today? Isn't it beautiful? It'll be 70-something degrees, sunny and pretty sky. It's just beautiful out there. How would you like for the weather to be just like this all the time? He said, oh, that'd be great. Well, I think what we should do is have some sort of a referendum. We could vote. What if we've got an election coming up? Did you know that it's coming up? What if one of the political platforms, a plank in the platform, was that if you will elect me, I'm going to make the weather 72 degrees every day with a blue sky. And we'll all vote on it. We'll all vote for the candidate to do that. Now, of course, that's pretty silly. The weather couldn't care less what you think. The weather is transcendent. It doesn't care what you think. The Bible is like that. By that I mean, generations come and generations go. Ours is not the only generation, it's just this one. And it's going to roll on like the others have done. And the truth of the Word of God is transcendent. It doesn't care what you think. We can vote on it if you want. You know, people today, we have this societal movement right now to change. It's as if everything is up for debate. Well, of course, that's not true. And the reality is that the Bible doesn't care what you think. And that's relative to our subject this morning. I say that not to be harsh. I say that just to focus our minds. Because, as I said yesterday, our faith is what is at issue here. Our faith declares that God is right. When you approach the home and marriage and how we're going to do it, we've gotten real messed up in America about what makes and constitutes a home, haven't we? I mean, we really did. Let's see, week before last, I was in Oklahoma, and it was near where one of the places my father preached when I was a boy, and I got a chance to go. I had a rented car, and I went to this little town where I was in third, fourth, fifth grade, right through there. And that was very interesting. When we were little, my sisters and I was in fifth grade, came time for Halloween, we'd go trick-or-treating on that street in those neighborhoods where I visited a couple of weeks ago, which is an amazing thing to do. You know, houses are much smaller when you go back to see them. But the point I want to make is that going, we used to go trick-or-treating without any adult supervision. I drove to my elementary school, and so I could exaggerate it, but I won't. It was several blocks, though, and I would often ride my bike by myself to school. That was very common then. I'm not very old. I'm just telling you that you think about things like that and you realize how we've transitioned in this country to a new America. And I would say to you that if you, and maybe this is oversimplification, but if you want to know, in my judgment, what happened, you can distill it down to one issue. We redefined home and we blew it. We let hell interfere with some basic fundamental things we knew about husbands and wives and mamas and daddies and raising the kid. And if you want to know, you look at a leader who is just utterly corrupt. The whole worldview is just twisted. The value system is wrong. If you want it, you say, well, how could that be? How can that happen? Just look at how the person was reared. Go back to the origin. How was the person trained, and how did the parents do? And then you learn a lot. Again, oversimplification, but it all gets back, I believe, to our family. So, with that in mind, let's launch into today. I'm going to talk in the first session about how to love a husband, then we're going to talk about some child-rearing things, then we're going to talk about the intimacy of marriage in the third session. All right. Proverbs 12 and verse 4 says, a virtuous woman is a crown to her husband, but she that makes ashamed is as rottenness in his bones. That last part's really very interesting. I've seen, and you have too, couples that are divorcing. Don't you know how, why do you suppose that in divorce, it so often gets very, very, very bitter, and the hatred, that love with which they loved one another, has turned so very dark. And it's very opposite. And the answer is that we're vulnerable to one another. There's no way that you can love a spouse without making yourself vulnerable. That's essential to love. You open yourself up, and that's a wonderful thing. It gives you joy in life, but it also creates the potential that my wife can hurt me more than anybody else. I was driving the other day back from lunch and going back to my office, and I was on this short street, and there was no one else on the street. It was half a mile long, I guess, and nobody else but me. And Cindy says sometimes that I am easily distracted. I think that's what she says. I'm not sure, but anyway, we're driving back, and I pulled up to a stop sign, and I heard this sound of somebody shouting, and I turned and looked, and there was a car there sitting beside me, and his window was rolled down, and he was shouting at me. And so I rolled down the window, and I said, "What is it?" And he said, "You pulled in front of me back there." I said, "Sir, I am sorry. I did not see you. I am sorry." I'm sure he's right. Even now, I don't remember. I didn't see him. But I tried to apologize. Well, it didn't help. And he was cursing, and he was angry. I said, "Listen, I just didn't see." "Yes, you did. You..." No, I didn't. "I didn't see you, but I'm sorry." He turned and went back to work. Do you know how long that bothered me? About 5 minutes. I mean, I wish I hadn't have done it. I regret pulling out in front of the guy. But his harsh words didn't penetrate my heart. If Cindy, if my wife, becomes angry with me and she says harsh things to me, not that she ever would, but if she did, I'm telling you, it goes right deep. It just zooms deep into me. Why is that? Why the difference? Two people? Why the difference? And the answer is vulnerability. Marriage and love necessitate vulnerability. I can hurt her more than anybody else in this world. Do you believe that? I would never do it, but I've got it within my power. That's the last part of this verse. But I want to focus on the first part. A virtuous woman is a crown to her husband. What is it that God, after creating a man with his innate needs that God formed and shaped, and here's how he wanted a man to be, what is it that he put into a woman to make her the crown to her husband? What is it that a woman does that makes her husband, an average husband, rejoice in his wife? Now I want you to think about that. What is it that makes an average man delight in his wife? All right, let's go on. Here's Proverbs 18:22. Whoso finds... Mrs. Connie and I were pulling out of the church lot one Sunday after worship, and we have a lot of teenagers, and one of our really sweet teenage girls, good, wonderful girl, anyway, she was walking across the lot, and so we stopped and let her cross, and I said, "Cindy, isn't she a pretty thing?" And Cindy said, "Now, Glenn, I don't think you should call a woman a thing. I don't think that's very nice." "Well, honey," I said, "the good book says, whoso finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord." That so seldom happens. I love that when that happens. Now, I want you to look at this verse and answer this question for me. What's good about you? And I'm not being silly. I'm asking you this question. So you're a crown to a virtuous woman is a crown to her husband. This passage says that a man who finds a wife finds a good thing. What's good about that? And the answer to that is that in all of creation, there's nothing that comes close to you to be the spouse to a man. There's no close second. There's nothing or no one or no creature that is suited for the role of a wife than a woman. God shaped and designed her in and out to be a man's wife. So the position, here's point number one, the position. In Genesis 2:18-20 in the King James, we have this term helpmeet. Now that's kind of funny because we changed it and we pushed it together. It's two words, help and meet. We pushed it together and we restated it, or we manufactured a word. We say helpmate. this, you know, I'm a helpmate. Not really. That's not even a word. But the words are help and meet. It's Old English, and you know what help means, obviously. But the word meet means perfectly suited for. A helper who is perfectly suited for her husband. So God in the garden created a man, and he created him with some, I don't want to say deficiencies, that's probably not a good way, but he created him with some empty spaces, and then he created the woman to fill those spaces, to complete the man. So it's not good that a man should be alone. Why not? Well, because God created these empty spaces inside of him. And then he made the woman to be the help meet for him. Now, I want you to hear me say this again. She is a crown to her husband. A virtuous woman's a crown to her husband. If a man finds a good wife, he finds a good thing and obtains favor of the Lord. She is his helper who is perfectly suited for him. Now, you come to the New Testament, And I want you to see, boy, you know what? If I went on Oprah Winfrey and said what I'm about to say, they would beat me about the head and shoulders. But it's the truth. The picture that you get in the Scriptures about a husband and his wife, married, going along in life, brace yourself, is not a picture of two parallel lives going along together. That is not your picture. It is a man and his wife who plays a supportive role to her husband. C.S. Lewis talked about this, and don't you love C.S. Lewis? And he said, you can't have two equal leaders in a marriage. It will fail. He said, because what will happen inevitably, if you have two equal leaders, and of course that's what the world says to us, is that marriage is like that. It's two equal leaders, equal in every way. But Lewis wisely observed that when you have two equal leaders, husband and wife, and you come to a serious, important decision, and you disagree, that you're at an impasse. If you're equal leaders and you disagree, then everything comes apart. So he said, what you've got to have, and what the Bible purports, is that you have the husband who is the leader and who is the head of the wife. So you get 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 3. Now, you're familiar with these passages, but I want to underscore the fact that there is no ambiguity. That's really critical. It's very, you could reject the Scriptures if you want to, but there's no ambiguity. And you ask yourself, did God know what he was doing? Doesn't he know that this isn't fair? Doesn't he know? What's the matter with him? And so we're challenged as the creatures to look to the Creator and say, we just think you got this wrong. You just hadn't figured this out. But the reality is that this goes so deep into the way that God created us. He created a man to be a man and a woman to be a woman. Now you fellas, you men, you'd make terrible women. You would. You're not cut out for it. And ugly to boot. You women, you'd make terrible men. You're not cut out to be a man. I'm really glad about that. I am. You know, feminist and feminine are side by side in the dictionary, but they're worlds apart. You must never give up your femininity. Never do it. Your husband didn't want to marry a man. He wanted a girl. Be a girl. Be a girl. God made you with this purpose in mind. All right. So 1 Corinthians 11 and 3, I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of the woman is the man, the head of Christ is God. No ambiguity. He's the head. And so here we have 1 Corinthians 11 verse 8. For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. Somebody asked me last night, came and said, I have this talk with a friend. And the friend says that the Bible teaches that the man is superior to the woman. He said, what do you think about that? Well, I said, I don't like that terminology. I think that's ambiguous. Well, I'm not sure what that even means. What I can tell you is that the Bible teaches that the man is the leader of the home and that the wife is to be submissive to her husband. So you have 1 Peter 3:1. Likewise, you wives, be in submission to your own husbands. What's interesting about this passage is that he's writing to a woman who's a Christian and her husband is not. And the question is, how can I help my husband? He won't come to worship with me. He won't come here preaching. What's my best shot at helping him be a Christian? And Peter writes in these first six verses and says, you be a faithful Christian in front of him. Show him that it's different. If you're a Christian, it's different. And you love him. If he'll connect the dots in his mind, you know, my wife is like this because she's connected to Jesus, to Christ. You may convert him. That's your best shot. Anyway, Cindy and I were having lunch one day with a preacher and his wife, considerably older than we. Eventually, they're both gone now, and eventually I would take a part in both of their funerals, which is a very hard thing for a preaching in a preaching life. It's what you do. But anyway, we got to talking about women, wives being in submission to their husbands, and he said, well, I've always thought that only has to do with spiritual things. Not with reference to everything, but just in spiritual matters, the wife is to be subject to her husband. And I said, well, you know, that's very interesting. Of course you're wrong about that. Well, Glenn, why do you say that? Well, because in 1 Peter chapter 3, Peter's writing to a woman who's a Christian and her husband's not. And why? How does that passage start out? Likewise, you wives, be in submission to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they may also without the word be won by the lifestyle of the wife, while they behold your chaste conversation, your lifestyle coupled with fear, and it goes on like that. The point is that here's another passage that shows that the man is created to be the leader of the home. Here's 1 Peter 3:5. Wow, brace yourself, buckle up, here we go. For after this manner, in the old time, the holy women also who trusted God adorned themselves, being in subjection to their own husbands, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. Now you would think that after such a statement as that, that he would go on to say, don't you think that's cute? And of course that was silly, right? That's how he would respond to what Sarah called Abraham Lord. Oh, don't you think that's funny? That's not what he said. He said, Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are if you do well. How do you like that? And incidentally, the word Lord here is the same word as Lord in Ephesians 5, talking about the Lord, about Christ. That's not to say that your husband is Christ. We know that. But it is to say that there's no ambiguity. The Scriptures teach that the husband is to be the leader of the family. He is the head. Now, we can fight this, but if we fight it, we'll do it to our own detriment. All right. Ephesians 5:22, wives, submit unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. Ephesians 5:33, nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and the wife see, and this is King James, that she reverence or respect her husband. Wow, that, you know, the clarity of that makes your head spin, because this is so very, very plain. All right, now here's the limit. So, Ephesians 5 says that a wife is to be submissive to her husband in everything. Does it mean everything, everything? There is one limit to it. Acts 5:29 says, we ought to obey God rather than men. In other words, if what your husband asks of you at any time is inconsistent with the New Testament, with the teachings of Jesus Christ, you obey Jesus instead of your husband. Now, and you can imagine, especially a woman who marries somebody who's not a Christian, he may want her to participate in entertainment, for example, that is inconsistent with Christianity, and she just can't do that. She won't do that. Or to try to prohibit her in some way from being faithful to her Lord. And I love you, honey, I love you, and I want to serve and follow you, your leadership, but I can't do that. I am a Christian, and I'm going to have to put him first. So Acts 5:29 says that. Now, the power. I expect that what I've said up to this point, for those of you who are Christians and familiar with the Scriptures, while I know this is probably not, these verses are familiar to you, not a surprise. But I'm going to tell you something now that I think may be a surprise. I'm convinced that a woman, the wife, has, and hear me out, a power over her husband that a husband doesn't have over his wife. Are you gonna buy into this? Well, follow me. Here's Proverbs 30 and verse 18. There be three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, for which I know not. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. Now that's very interesting. Too wonderful, too awesome to grasp. The way of a man with a maid. I believe that a man is like a dog and a woman is like a cat. Now, I mean nothing offensive. I know that this illustration portrays the men like dogs, and they're of my own kind, so I'm not trying to be offensive. But it's what I think. A man's like a dog and a woman's like a cat. Now, we've had both at the Colley House. And I had declared early on that we were never going to have an inside cat. Cats are meant to be outside. Until Hannah was a teenager and she wanted inside cat something awful, and Cindy used the magic words on me. Maybe not the words you're thinking. She said, "Well, Glenn, you know she's only going to be young once. Okay, let's get the cat." And so we've had both. We've had dogs. The worst thing I think about a cat is that he's not a dog. All right, that's what I think. But that's opinion. All right. I want you to think about the difference between a cat and a dog. If you have a cat, you come home from work, and the cat is across the room, and you say, "Come here, baby, come here. Let me stroke you, and I'm going to pet you, and I've bought you some food that costs more than what I'm going to have for supper, and I want to give it to you. Come here, baby." And what she's going to do, she'll look at you like this, and some days she'll come, and other days she's going to do this. Right? She's going to walk right away. Now, what I suggest is if you don't like that, you could take her to the vet. Take her to the vet. Put her up on the table. "Well, what's the matter?" And explain. I come home and she might or might not come to me. What's the vet going to say? What's he going to say? He's going to say, "Well, the thing is, this is a cat, see? Now, that'll be $75. Right? That's what he's going to say, or she's going to say. Now, what if it's a dog? What if it's a dog? Come home, and you might have whipped that dog the day before. It doesn't matter. I mean, the only difference would be he'd come with his tail tucked between his legs. But you get to the door and you say, "Come here, boy. I want to pet you. I want to feed you some dog food that I bought in a 50-pound bag at Walmart. It costs $2 and tastes like cardboard." But you won't get that whole sentence out, will you? You won't get the whole sentence out. Because he's drawn to you. He's coming, isn't he? Now, if he doesn't do that, and you take him to the vet and explain it to the vet, what's the vet going to say? He's going to say, "Yeah, we probably need to check him over. Something's not right if he's not doing that, if he's not coming. He's sick. Something's the matter with him." Now, I'm telling you that God did that. You're talking about two different animals. And God made them differently. I'm asserting that human beings are that way, and there's a difference between a man and a woman. And to put a point on it, that God made a man, created men to be vulnerable to a woman who loves and respects and honors him. It wasn't just that God made man with this kind of black and white logic thinking process. It was that he wired him in such a way that man is vulnerable. That's the best word I can think of for this purpose. A typical man is vulnerable to a woman who loves and respects and honors him. Now, I would offer this further evidence of this. In 1 Peter chapter 3 that I referenced a while ago, and you know, about a woman who's a Christian and she's married to a man who's not a Christian, he says, if you want to convert him to the Lord, you live a faithful Christian life in front of him. Who's adorning, that's passage that says, who's adorning, let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair, of wearing of gold, or putting on of apparel. Very few men know the difference between a real diamond and a paste one. Right? That's not teaching that a woman shouldn't try to make herself presentable or beautiful for her husband. That's not the point. But the point is, as he goes on, but let it be the hidden man of the heart. That's how she should view her greatest virtue, her greatest attraction to him. Let it be the hidden man of the heart and that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great value. The point is that man is created in such a way by God. And I know that there are anomalies, there are exceptions. But a typical man is created and he is vulnerable to his wife, to her respect and love and honor of him. So in that passage in 1 Peter chapter 3, this is never said in the reverse. A woman might convert her husband just by being around him that way, just by showing him the way that she lives. And he's drawn to that. He's influenced by her that way. Now you say, well, that might happen in the reverse. It might happen if the wife was a Christian. I mean, the husband was a Christian, the wife wasn't. It might, but the Bible doesn't say it that way. I just think that's interesting. And the reason is that, are you ready for this? A man is like a dog, and a wife is like a cat. God put the wife in a submissive role in the marriage, but he also gave her a strength, a power in his life, in the life of a man, that is not true in the reverse. All right, let's make some suggestions. One, remember that you'll never force him into loving you. You never will. I want to suggest to you that you remember what drew him to you in the first place. It was femininity. It was femininity. And close to that, I want you to adore him like you did when you asked him to marry you. Yes, you did. You know how you did it? I tell you what you do sometime. Go on Friday night to where teenagers take their dates to eat. I don't know where that would be. I don't know if they go to McDonald's, but anyway, wherever they go, go and sit down at the table where you can see some kids, and you watch, and that little old girl, she's listening to him, and she smiles, she laughs at his jokes that aren't very funny, and he just can't get enough of her. She's interested in him, and she finds him fascinating, and he wants her for his own. He wants to protect her and provide for her and all of these masculine things that he wants to envelop her and have her for his own, right? Something going on there that has to do with creation. I have to apologize again about the rudeness of this. Resist maternal correcting. Don't be a chihuahua. I don't mean to be rude. Sometimes Cindy says I'm rude, but of course that's very rude for her to say. You ever watch a mama around her children? You got some great mamas in this room. And one of the ways that a main way that a mama expresses love to her children is by correcting them. And she's doing it all through the day. I mean, it's rather constant. She's watching them. They're on her radar. She knows where those babies are. And so she'll say, now, honey, you've got to sit down and tie your shoe because you're going to fall down. Now, I want you to eat two bites of that. You cannot have any dessert until you eat two bites of those awful Brussels sprouts. Right? I don't want you to sit over there. I want you to sit over there. Why are you standing up? I want you to sit down right over there. Go pick up those toys. No, don't put them there. Put them. And so she's doing that, right? And what is she saying to those children? But I love you. I love you. And I'm rearing you to be good and honorable and respectable people. That's what I'm doing. And so she's correcting them all the time. If you're not careful, ladies, you can fall into doing that with your husband. You can get to where you don't mean it. You don't mean it. But you get to where you're like a chihuahua. And a chihuahua never bites you very hard. They're at your ankles, you know, they're grabbing at you all the time. If you get into this nasty habit of this constant correcting of him, why are you sitting over there? Why don't you sit over here? Why didn't you turn back there? You know, you should have turned back. And why don't you? And just correcting him all the time. And what's coming out of your mouth isn't hatred. What's coming out of your mouth is, I love you, and I'm that's because I love you. I'm trying to help you be better. But that's not what's going into his ears. What's going into his ears is, you're broken and I'm here to fix you. Ladies, a man's greatest fear in his marriage is that he won't be good enough. He doesn't want to be your project. He wants to be your hero. You want your husband to reach his potential in life? Don't be his chihuahua. Be his wife. And treat him like the leader of your family. Treat him with respect. And he'll break his ever-loving neck trying to be what you think he is. Let me give you a little secret about you. You have a special occasion, maybe an anniversary. Next time you have an anniversary, you want to get him a card, and you go to the store and you pay a ridiculous price for a Hallmark card. Whoever heard $4.50 for a card, and it says something very poetic, and you sign it and you say X and O's, and he gets it and he says, "Thank you, sweetie." And as soon as your back is turned, he's going to throw it away. He may wait till the next day, but it's going to, you know what? You'll keep a card like that probably. It's wonderful and sweet and kind, but you probably won't keep it. You want me to tell you how that you can give your husband a card that he will never throw away? That's a pretty strong statement. But you don't have to spend $4.50. Just get a good piece of paper, because this is going to have to last. And it'll be a piece of paper that I expect he's going to keep. And one day your great-grandchildren are going to dig it out of a trunk and say, "Well, just look at this. Here's what you do." At the top of the paper, write, "These are the things I respect about you." And then make the list. What do you respect about your man? Tell him about what he is, and about leadership and protection and provision and the hard things that he does. You know, a daddy is somebody in the hard times when everything's coming apart and people are crying and distressed. He's the one that gets real strong and hard. And he says, "This is what we're going to do." What do you respect about your man? Write it on a piece of paper. If you can come up with 30 things, that's a plus. And then at the bottom say, "And I sure do love you," and give it to him. And he'll keep it. Don't be a chihuahua. And would you just forgive me for using a rude analogy here? Please forgive me. I understand that there are occasions when you need to work on issues in families and couples, and sometimes I understand that they're big and significant and you've got to deal with them or the marriage can't sustain. I've got that. I'm not talking about those kinds of things when I reference maternal correcting. I'm talking about those trivial things that don't matter a snap. They don't really matter. The truth is, after you go past that exit back there, you can't reverse time. And you know, what good is it to fuss at him because he didn't take that exit? What good is that? He can't reverse time. All it serves is a little bit of pain you jabbed him with. And I can tell you this, a man can die the death of 1,000 cuts. Don't do it. Just don't do it. And the reason is that man's not a woman. He never will be a woman. God designed him with characteristics. He gets his feelings hurt, but he's not a woman. He's designed with characteristics where he's rather black and white in the way he thinks. Why do you suppose that Satan tempted Eve instead of Adam? Why do you suppose he did? Don't you think that's interesting? It doesn't really make sense on its face. Looks like he'd gone to Adam. He's the man. He's created first and all that. And he leads Eve. Wouldn't that be better sense? But he didn't. And look how he attracted Eve. Look at this fruit, and it's sort of an aesthetic kind of argument. It's beautiful to look upon, and don't you think this will be delicious? And you say, "Oh, look at that, look at that. This will make you wise. Why, Eve, you're like little kittens in the woods with your eyes not open yet, but if you eat this fruit, you're going to be like little gods. Wouldn't you like that power? Huh? Wouldn't you like that?" And Eve took it and she ate it. I don't think it would have been that way had he made the same approach to Adam. I don't think so, you know. A man, of course, now Adam yielded, and after he saw what was going on with Eve, I think that he ate of the fruit in order to follow Eve. He didn't know where she was going, but he didn't want to be without her. I think he probably ate of it for that reason. But I also think that if Adam had been the one who was approached by the devil, that Adam would have taken the snake by the tail and thrown him. I don't think, you know, because it's kind of black and white. I don't care about how pretty the fruit is. God said, don't eat it, and I'm not, you know what? Forget this. Forget you, right? A marriage between a man and a woman is sort of like a turtle. And that outside shell, let that represent the husband. And the inside part, much softer, much more tender tissue. You know what? That's like the woman. I'm so glad about that. I mean, when you were a kid and you skinned your knee and bloodied it up a little bit, why, was it different when you went to your mama and when you went to your daddy? Was it different? Yeah, you go to your mama and you say, oh, look at my knee, it was so bloody. You know, and what's mama going to do? Oh, honey, come here. And she's going to clean you up. Let me get you some Bactine. And you probably need a Band-Aid, don't you? I sure do. I need a Band-Aid. And that thing, she's going to hug and kiss on you. What would happen if you went to your dad? Well, son, just spit on it, rub dirt in it. Let's go on. You're all right. I think we need both. I think a kid needs both. And I think that's part of the design. The truth is that if we didn't have daddies, we only had mamas, kids would never leave home. You know, a dad's the one that says, now, honey, I love you, but now you know you're going to have to launch out. Because he knows. There's a benefit to how different we are. And the point of this session is that not only that God made the men to be the leaders, but the point of this session is that you need to be a student of your spouse. You need to be a student of your man, of your husband. And don't try to make him more feminine. That's the world's idea. And how's that working out for you? Huh? How's that working out for you? Let's make the men more like women. Let's make them softer and make them more like... Now, I'm not opposed to kindness. The Bible teaches kindness and forgiveness and gentleness. And we've been talking about that. And a man's to love his wife. He loves his own body. I understand all of that. But I also understand that a man... Listen, we need men in the homes, don't we? We need men. Don't try to change him into being a woman or like a woman. Love him for being a man and then honor him because he's the head of your family. Honor him as the head of your home. And he will break his neck trying to be the man that you believe him to be. Let's pray. Thank you, O Lord, for all the ways you bless us and for loving us. Thank you. Thank you for our marriages. And help us, Father, to ponder and then to submit to your will in the way that marriage ought to be. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's take a break for 7.2 minutes and we'll resume.